yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, 99 percenters. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Well, we have continued fallout from the escalation of the trade war last week. To recap briefly, Trump's trade team came back from Shanghai empty-handed. Why? Well, Trump was desperate to get the Chinese to buy more agricultural goods, because if he doesn't get an agreement, which he won't now, we'll explain why, he's going to have to come up with another $20 billion in subsidies to the U.S. agribusiness and farm sector. He's already given him $30 billion. He's going to have to give him $20 billion. He will before the election. Well, how can he simply do that? Well, because he's already violated constitutional norms in relationships with the U.S. Congress, and he just moves the money around wherever he wants. You see, it used to be that the U.S. Congress, in this case the House of Representatives, which raised money bills, passes legislation and earmarks the spending, you know, for agriculture or for transport or for defense or whatever, and that's where the money was to be spent, and has been spent up until Trump. Now he's already created a precedent. He'll just move the money from one pot to whatever pot he likes. It's part of a growing constitutional crisis in this country, and Trump's driving it. Well, you know, he's going to continue to do that. He'll just move the money around. Okay, so we have this trade war here, recap last week when Trump's team came back from Shanghai empty-handed. They went over there telling the Chinese, buy some more agricultural goods and we will continue negotiation. In other words, you do that first. and the Chinese obviously must have asked him, well, what about the tariffs? You know, you want a concession from us? We said before we'd buy $5 trillion more. We put that on the table of ag goods. Well, are you going to lift the tariffs? No. Well, then what do we have to negotiate? You know, one-way negotiation, is that what you're coming over here for? And I'm sure the U.S. team, led by the neocons, said, well, look, you know, we gave you a concession here on Huawei. We're letting Huawei sell some low-level non-tech goods in the U.S. By the way, Huawei doesn't need it. Huawei's got record global profits. So the Trump team was saying, you know, we'll let you buy some low-cost semiconductor stuff, but you got to start buying big time, billions, tens of billions of U.S. ag goods. Well, that's not much of an offer. And, of course, the Trump team came back empty-handed. And then they gathered in Trump's office. This is reported by the Business Press, you see. And they debated what to do next. And the neocons, Navarro and Lighthizer and so forth, said, let's raise tariffs. But the more reasoned heads, you know, like Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, represents the big bank's interest, said, no, you know, you do that, you're going to precipitate a problem here. They're going to respond. Well, Trump listens to his neocons now on just about everything. And in this case, he listened to the neocons and he raised tariffs 10% on remaining $300 billion of imports from China. already at 25% on $250 billion, but now it's additional 10% on $300 billion. By the way, you know, Trump, when he met with President China, President Xi, back in Osaka in late June, June 29th, at the G20 meeting, he promised he would not raise rates. Well, he broke his promise. Well, you can imagine what the Chinese felt. You know, here they come over, they give, you know, don't negotiate, don't make any reasonable offer, and then they renege on their past promises. We can't trust whatever this guy says. And that's true for everybody that deals with Trump on this trade issue. There's never a closure, never a good faith stand by what you said. Everything is subject to reversal and change. That's the way this guy did business. That's his strategy. You know, I get something, then I'm going to, you know, renege on it to get something else. Nothing's ever agreed to with this guy. And everyone's getting his number globally. Well, he listened to the neocons, raised rates, and then what did the Chinese do? Well, they responded by doing nothing. In other words, what I meant is they allowed their currency to devalue based on global forces. They didn't have to intervene to manipulate their currency. No, they just let market forces, slowing global economy, cause their currency, the yuan, to break through its 7-to-1 band. That's the trading band, 7 yuan to $1. And if it goes higher than 7, then you got a devaluation. In other words, it takes more yuan to buy a dollar. That's a devaluation. So they let it drift up to 7.1 something. Well, that's a threshold that breaks through the band, the official band. That gives a signal that the currency might devalue even more. Sent shockwaves across the global economy that, oh, well, gee, we may be on the verge to a currency war here. The important point is, it's not currency manipulation. In fact, China for years has been entering the money markets to prop up its currency to prevent it from devaluing. That's been its practice for 5 years now. Yeah, not manipulate it to devalue it. By the way, if the currency devalues, it offsets the tariffs from the U.S., you see. They could easily offset Trump tariffs by letting market forces devalue their currency, run it to 7.3, 7.5 to the dollar or something, and negate Trump. They don't need to do that because, look, latest report, Chinese exports have increased globally. In other words, the Trump strategy of tariffs are failing miserably. Yeah. So they let this thing devalue over the weekend. Last weekend this was. And they also said to Trump, we're not going to buy any more agricultural goods from you. At least, you know, the government, state-owned industries. They're called SOEs, state-owned enterprises in China. We're not going to buy any ag goods. And by the way, you know, we could put tariffs, taxes, export tariffs on our private companies that want to buy ag goods from you. We can do that next. Well, that's why they came back empty-handed, you see. So the markets imploded over the weekend. Last weekend, you know, stock markets dropped 700 points, 300, 400 points, you know, several days in a row. And of course, all that money running out of the stock markets ran right back into the bond markets, buying treasuries. And treasury prices surged. We had the biggest treasury boom, price boom here in years going on, and still is. I'll explain why and why it will continue. You know, the stock market and bond prices move in opposition. And that's because when people are selling stocks, right, the prices of stocks decline, and when they turn around and they buy bonds and treasuries, increases the demand for treasuries, and the price rises. And of course, if the price rises, then the yields or interest rates on bonds decline, and we're seeing that happen as well. Which produces the yield curve. What's the yield curve? That's when short-term rates are higher than longer-term rates. You see, the Fed central banks can only influence short-term rates. Long-term rates are driven by global economic conditions. You know, right now we have what's called an inverted yield curve. Yield curve, yield meaning interest rates, right? We've got 10-year treasuries at 1.6, in fact, at percent. It dropped to a day or so ago to 1.5. And all the other rates are much lower than even that 5-year, 2-year treasuries. And what is the government's, the Federal Reserve's, official benchmark rate? Well, the Fed lowered it to 2 to 2.25, 2%. Well, the other rates are well below it. In other words, real rates in marketplace are now lower than the Fed rate, which means the Fed rate has no effect. It's dead in the water. You know, if I want to borrow money, you know, I can borrow it cheaper than at the Fed rate if I'm a bank. See, the federal funds rate by the Fed is the rate that banks borrow from each other roughly overnight. That's the benchmark rate. Supposed to influence all other rates. Well, other rates are falling faster because investors in the global economy is slowing faster than the Fed is responding to it. The Fed's behind the curve. Well, the Fed was behind the curve in 2008. It was raising rates in 2008, raised them to 5.25, and the economy was in recession and collapsing. Yeah, and the same thing happened in 2000, before the 2001 recession. Rates were raised to 6.5%. And when you have rates that high in relationship to other rates, it precipitates a contraction. The rates don't cause the recession, but they precipitate the recession. Okay, so 6.5% in 2000. By the way, it was 8% in 1990 before that recession. 6.5% in 2000 before the 2001 recession. 5.25% in 2007-8 before the Great Recession. And now they peaked at only 2.75 or 3/8. You know, and they lowered it now for the first time in 10 years down to 2%. Well, the other rates are way below it. This is having big repercussions globally, which means the Fed will definitely lower rates in September. The question is, will they lower rates by 50 basis points, so the 0.5%, or just 25 again? Well, we'll see. There's big debates going on within the Fed and within the economy, whether it'll be 0.25% or 0.5%. We'll see what happens there. Okay, but the point is that Trump's trade war, especially with China, is really exacerbating the slowdown of the global economy. I say exacerbating because it's not the only cause. You know, after 10 years, the business cycle inevitably in a capitalist system will turn down. Plus, we haven't had really that big of a expansion of the real economy because a lot of the money capital, free money created by the central banks has gone, as I've said many times, into financial assets or mergers and acquisitions or just sitting there on balance sheets. Doesn't go into real investment as much as it used to. Okay, so it's been cooling off, slowing, naturally. as capitalist systems do, real investment slowing, GDP slowing. But the trade thing is slowing even faster. First quarter this year, according to the IMF, global trade only grew at 0.5%. The global economy is almost flat. Probably is by now. Third quarter. This is the first time that global trade is actually growing slower, not growing at all now, than global GDP. It always was. Trade was growing faster than global GDP, which would be driving GDP. Now, it's not driving GDP, it's slowing GDP, because it's below, the growth rate's below. That's a big change, which means that the global trade pie, you know, is flat. It's not growing anymore, and it's shrinking in places and about to shrink in general. And that's why we have this global trade fight. The U.S. sees this, and neoliberal policies are about protecting U.S. share of global trade. So Trump is trying to change the rules of the game, you see. Change the rules of the global game to protect U.S. economic interests. That's what the trade war is all about, you see, ultimately. U.S. neoliberalism has been very flexible since Reagan in protecting U.S. business interests. But it hit a wall in 2008-09, almost blew it up, and Trump's trying to restore it. Well, that's the theme of my forthcoming book next month called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. We have a restoration attempt underway with Trump to create a neoliberalism 2.0, but as I argue in a book, it's going to fail. Well, what does that produce? Well, it contributes to the crisis, the failure, although the failure is a consequence of the crisis as well. And we're going to have another crisis in the 2020s here and another restructuring of the economy, just as we had when neoliberalism was created in the late 70s, early 80s, just as we had a restructuring after World War II with Bretton Woods, just as we had a restructuring in the U.S. on the eve of World War I. You see, capitalism goes into these restructurings phases in order to maintain and advance itself. Restructurings are not business cycle swings. These are something more fundamental, structural, that occur periodically as well, every several decades. In the U.S., as I said, right before World War I, coming out of World War II, in World War I, it was about the U.S. placing itself on an equal basis with European capital. Yes, the U.S. ascendant as Europe, with European capital, British capital, French capital, right? Coming out of World War II with Bretton Woods in the late 40s, it was about the U.S. taking over global hegemony in the capitalist system. Neoliberalism is a response to the slowdown of the global economy and the crisis in the 1970s in the advanced economies. Neoliberalism has been evolving in various policy directions ever since. But it hit a wall in 2008, you see, with the Great Recession, and it's trying to restore itself under Trump, but as I argue, it will fail. All right, that's The Scourge of Neoliberalism. You'll be able to check it out on my blog and my website, Clarity Press, Amazon, whatever, here next month. All right, back to the trade war here, right? Okay, so coming out of last week in the collapse of the markets, Trump declared, oh, currency manipulation. You know, this is the old hackneyed phrase they've been using since 2015-16 during the elections, right? That was a talking point. And it was false then. You know, the argument is, oh, they're manipulating their currency to maintain an advantage over the U.S. and in trade. Well, if they were manipulating, it was to keep their currency up, appreciated, which would not give them an advantage, quite the opposite. Well, you know, coming out of last week, Trump was saying, oh, manipulation, that whole talking point. Mm-hmm. You know, he could have taken a harder line. He didn't. You know, currency manipulation doesn't mean anything. All it means is that if the U.S. Treasury says, oh, yeah, the country's a currency manipulator, then the U.S. can take action like cutting or raising tariffs. Well, it's already raising tariffs. You know, what else is it going to do? So I see what came out of last weekend as kind of a both sides saying, well, you know, let's back off here and let's just accept the status quo for a while and cool off. China, you know, sent a shot across the bow to the Trump administration. You know, you want to do more tariffs? We'll do more devaluation. We'll just let the global economy do it. We don't have to do it. And we're not going to buy any of your ag goods either. So there. Right. Well, Trump is now saying, and it looks like this is the strategy in the wake of the failure in Shanghai. Well, they're going to go after Huawei now, even more, and other Chinese companies, you see. But there won't be any more tariff hikes, I predict. Trump has been burned. He listened to his neocons. Neocons screwed up again. Hey, look. Look at the neocons in office in the last year having Trump's ear. Right? Saner capitalist heads have left the administration and in droves here. All of them, even the generals, left in disgust. And what's happened? Well, now you got in the vacuum, all the neocons have come in. You know, this guy Miller driving immigration problems, a Bolton foreign policy, Navarro Lighthizer trade policy, Pompeo, right? It's scary. They're driving the show. And look, in the past, whenever they did, they screwed it up royal. And they're screwing it up again. Look, you know, everywhere. Trump was trying to get a deal with North Korea. Well, they scuttled that. Trump went over there and just like going to Shanghai, you know, Pompeo and others went over to North Korea and Trump was going to maybe meet with, you know, Kim. And he had nothing to say, and it turned out to be a bust. And ever since then, the discussions with North Korea on the missiles have gone nowhere. Well, they don't want a deal with North Korea. Neocons don't want a deal. They want to keep the pot boiling. It's good for defense sales. Good for next generation nuclear and military development. And look what happened in Venezuela. Well, they tried to engineer a coup there. Well, that flopped, didn't it? So now they're just imposing more sanctions. Any company that does any business will be sanctioned. With Venezuela will be sanctioned now by the U.S. Latest Bolton. The Venezuela thing was Bolton's play. The same thing in Iran. That's Bolton's play. Provoke a war with Iran. Hasn't gone anywhere, has it? Settled into a state. You know, all their initiatives from Korea to Iran to Venezuela and foreign policy are dead in the water. And, of course, so is the trade policy, which is a neocon policy. Because the trade war is really a tech war, you see. It's really about technology. That's the bête noire behind the scenes here. The appearance is a trade war. And yes, there are trade issues that the U.S. wants to achieve. You know, it wants to get majority ownership of U.S. businesses in China. It wants to sell more ag goods. Wants to sell more natural gas export. These things are true. But really, what's holding it all up is the tech war. Yeah. They want China to capitulate on next generation technologies like 5G, AI, cybersecurity. Because these are the technologies, military technologies of the next decade, you see. They're not just economic technologies. And the neocons running trade policy want a capitulation by China or no deal. They will not accept any kind of deal being finalized that will mean walking away from their demands on capitulation on these tech issues by China. And they've scuttled two agreements already on trade. First one in May 2018. Then running the show, Mnuchin comes back from Beijing and he says, we got a deal. You know, they're going to give us 51% ownership of our operations and they're going to buy trillions of dollars more of our ag goods. Hey, this is a good deal. Let's grab it. Oh, you know. Neocons and their friends in the Pentagon and their friends in the military committees in Congress, you know, blocked it, blew it up. And then when Trump met with Xi at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires in December of 2018, it looked like it was going to be opened again. And they went through some negotiations earlier this year, thought they had a deal. Chinese team was coming to Washington, and at the last minute, the neocons threw up unacceptable demands. Like, oh, no, we're not going to pull back any of our tariffs. No. And, oh, by the way, you've got to stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises as if the U.S. didn't subsidize its companies with tax cuts and direct payments. Yeah. And, we're going to continue to go after Huawei, even if we have a deal. Oh, and by the way, you got to share your next generation technology developments with us. Well, those were unacceptable demands thrown up in a week or two before, in May, China trade team was about to come over. Well, China came over anyway. They probably couldn't believe it's true. You know, they talked to Trump, and yeah, it's true. So they walked away. And then Trump met again with Xi at the G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan. A repeat, you know, of Buenos Aires was in the works. Trump comes out with all these happy talk and platitudes about a good buddy he is with Xi, all right? Apparently promised not to raise rates on the other $300 billion. And then the U.S. team goes over to, the neocon-dominated team goes over to Shanghai, and no deal. Well, that brings us full circle. It's a circus. To where we started this discussion, right? So no tariff hikes here anymore. Settle back into a kind of a status quo. And Trump even said today that no deal. Doesn't look like we're ever going to get it. No deal expected, right? He says, I can wait. No deal. I can wait. Talking, you know, as if he's the one driving the show. Right? That's the spin. It means there's no agreement this year for sure. and probably not next year, unless the U.S. and Trump, the economy is slow enough and Trump wants to grab what's on the table before the election. In other words, grab China's agreement to buy more agricultural goods, which he needs to have, you know, for his red states, for his election. He needs to do that, or he's got to come up with $20 billion more, which he'll probably do both, and take the money out of food stamps or something. So he may grab the economic concessions already made by China and come back for another bite at the apple after the election on the tech issue. That could happen, but it might not happen because the military and the neocons are adamant. They don't want a deal without a capitulation on tech. And, you know, draft dodger Trump here, yeah, he was a draft dodger during the Vietnam War, you know. He just loves the military. He loves them. And he may just listen to him. Yeah, he may not take the money and run next year. Well, but you look at the markets, and what are the markets? The markets are getting very, very fragile, and indigestion is growing with the fact there's no resolution to the trade dispute, and it's going to get worse. The trade dispute is undermining global business confidence and therefore undermining business investment. Uncertainty is the driver of business and disinvestment, and uncertainty is growing. Business investment is falling everywhere, including the U.S., and as a result, economies are weakening, especially those economies heavily dependent on exports, like Germany. Let's talk about Germany. Germany, what, 40% of Europe GDP is due to the German economy. And it's in big trouble. German GDP comes out next week. Probably will show that GDP in second quarter was absolutely flat. May even show it was negative. Right? And indicators are slowing more in the second quarter, so it's definitely negative in the third quarter. Right? The July Purchasing Managers Index, PMI, in Germany hit a 7-year low, just reported. 7-year low. In other words, it's where it was during the recession in Europe of 2011-13. It's in another recession. The Purchasing Managers Index is another recession. Construction Index is now turned negative as well in Germany. And the Services Index is slowing. You know, the recessions always spill over from manufacturing and construction into services. Services are the last to contract. And you got to have, for services to contract, you got to have unemployment to start rising. And the first indicator of trouble in the labor market and imminent unemployment is when businesses start cutting hours worked. That's the first step. And that's happening in Germany. And by the way, it's happening now in the U.S. You see, employment is always a lagging indicator. It always lags, a lagging statistic. But the anteroom to that statistic, and its shift downwards, is hours worked. Employers cut back on hours worked before they lay off. But it's when you have hours worked and then layoffs, you have a decline in consumption income, and that's what drives services, and services then fall. Okay. So the recession is here in Germany. It's also been here in Italy. And now latest indications are that the UK economy is now in a recession. Second quarter GDP contraction here. France is only growing at 0.2%. So look across Europe here. You know, big economies, Italy, UK, Germany, all in recession. And France, damn close. And the only reason it's not is because the French last year threw in some fiscal stimulus in response to the demonstrations, the yellow vest demonstrations, you know. But that will dissipate and France will follow the same direction. And all this is occurring on the eve of a hard Brexit going to occur this year. Now that Boris Johnson is the new PM, Prime Minister in Britain, and he's pretty much put a stake in the ground, you know, there will be a hard Brexit, unless the British capitalists can figure out how to maneuver and prevent him from doing that. You know, there's a wing of British capital that's been stalling this Brexit thing successfully, but they may not be able to continue to do that, but they're going to try. There'll probably be a constitutional crisis in Parliament of some sort. We'll see. Well, that means he'll have to have new elections. Him, Boris, Bobo, as he's called, Bojo. He's called Bojo. Bojo. It used to be a clown called Bobo in the U.S. Well, he's Bojo, the clown. All right, so hard Brexit will have a big negative impact on business confidence, both in the U.K. and Europe, and cause the recession to deepen. And now in Italy, it looks like there's going to be a new election there. Salvini, the PM there, is breaking with his colleagues, Five Star Movement, and demanding an election, another election. And if he gets a majority there, he will break the Eurozone rule on fiscal spending, and that will cause a further crisis and really undermine monetary policy, which already is not working in the Eurozone anymore. So Europe is a weak link. So weak link in the global capitalist economy. Even as the economies of the U.S. and China are slowing as they battle out over this trade thing, slowing everything down, you got Europe in trouble. And there's another one to watch, and that's India. India. On the surface, it looks as if India is growing at 6%. But look, India GDP is phony. A couple of years back, they redefined the whole thing and doubled the growth rate by redefining it. Make it look better than it actually is. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. In other words, my Indian investor friends say, hey, you know, look, we all know, take the India GDP and cut it in two, cut it in half, and that's about what the growth rate is. Well, that would make the growth rate around 3%, but slowing fast. There are big troubles in the Indian economy, which by now is almost the fifth largest GDP in the world. So it's pretty important. Fifth largest, yeah. This year will overtake the UK economy in size. Isn't that ironic? Yeah, the number one economy, the colonial economy of the British Empire, now greater than the UK economy. Well, it's an indicator that the UK is destined to be an economy on par with Northern Italy and increasingly dependent on the U.S. That's why they're desperate for, quote, a special trade relationship with the U.S. The U.S. isn't going to give them any special deals. They'll squeeze them. And the U.K. will become dependent on the U.S. just as it's now dependent on Europe. So choose who you want to be dependent on, but you're going to be dependent, UK. Nothing you can do about it. Okay, so what we got here is first quarter of this year, GDP in India, despite its overestimation, was the lowest growth in 5 years. And there's big trouble with the currency. The currency is devaluing pretty fast as the economy slows and as the central bank lowers interest rates dramatically. And as shadow banks and defaults begin to appear everywhere in India now, shadow bank defaults, you know, a lot of phony speculation going on in India for years now, financial speculation and defaults in various sectors, corporate defaults beginning to appear. And at some point, we're going to have a classical financial crisis a la 2008 emerging in India. India banks, by the way, non-performing bank loans, trillions, hundreds of billions, rather, hundreds of billions in non-performing bank loans in India. In other words, the banks are, on many of them, are on the cusp of collapse in India. Modi, who is the prime minister there, a right-winger, you know, in the tradition of Bolsonaro and Salvini and Orban, right, and Duterte in the Philippines, and Bojo now in the UK, you know, nationalists, radical nationalists, right? Well, he pushed through some spending bills to try to prop up the economy, but the problem is India is heavily dependent on money and goods flows with the rest of Asia and the rest of the world. And as that all slows, India is going to slow too, and its currency is going to decline even further. Well, India is one of the central banks, that just recently in the last few days or weeks, last couple of weeks, are engaging in a race to the bottom. Central banks globally are in a race to the bottom, meaning to lower their interest rates. India just lowered it. Thailand, New Zealand, Philippines, and before that, Mexico, Indonesia, South Africa, South Korea. All around the world, central banks are lowering rates. Why? Because they're trying to get ahead of the lowering of rates by the Fed and the ECB. That's about to occur in September. Right? Trying to get ahead. Well, why wouldn't they try to get ahead? Because if they don't lower their interest rates, their currencies will end up relatively higher in relationship to the dollar because currencies move in relationship to interest rates in large part. And as interest rates decline, the currency weakens, devalues. Well, if it devalues, then their exports are more competitive. So they're lowering rates to lower their currency in order to maintain their share of export, the global export pie. Once again, we're back to this whole idea of the global economy stagnating, going nowhere, and precipitating fights amongst the different capitalist countries to hold on to their share of the pie, you see. It's not just the U.S. and Trump that's doing this while he's leading the parade, but the others are responding as well. It's even got to a point that, you know, Japan and South Korea are really feuding over trade now. Yeah, in other words, the slowing global trade and global GDP, Trump response, trade war, slowing global economies are precipitating these intercapitalist fights over trade. It's a sign of the growing instability in the global capitalist economy. Yeah. So all of these countries there that I just mentioned, with central banks lowering, their rates. It's a race to the bottom. And as they lower their rates to influence their currencies, that's a reflection of the emerging global currency war that ultimately set in motion by Trump, because the dollar is the global trading currency. So what we got is a currency war now. The trade war, the tariff war, is morphing into a currency war. You know, even the business press and talking heads are admitting that now. I've been predicting that as the next phase for a year. And, of course, the U.S. and China are locked into not just the tariff war, not just the trade war, and not even just a currency or even tech war. It's an economic war between China and the U.S., early stages. We're witnessing that right now. And it will continue after the election. And by the way, it will continue even if Democrats get elected, because the money bags wing of the Democratic Party, the Pelosi Schumers, right, they're in total agreement with Trump on the trade war with China. In total agreement. You know, and from the capitalist perspective, you know, they may not be wrong, because next generation, 2020s, fight over technology, industries of the future, next gen technologies, military dominance determined by next gen technologies. Yeah, they see China as the big threat. Look, most of the tech patents in the world are filed by the U.S. and China, about an equal amount, and about 90% of all the patents, tech patents, are by these two countries. Everyone else is, you know, miles behind. Germany a little bit, Japan a little bit, Russia a little bit, but all the rest are way behind. They've lost the tech war. There's only two countries that are going to dominate next decade, and they're duking it out over which one's going to be the leader, China, U.S. Yep. In the meantime, you know, we have a global manufacturing recession that has erupted everywhere. PMIs, Purchasing Manager Indexes, manufacturing, are down everywhere. We are in a global recession in manufacturing. And historically, recessions traditionally spill over from manufacturing into the other sectors of the economy. That's the transmission channel. You know, one exception to this was 2008-09. It didn't start in manufacturing spillover to services. It started on the financial side. Yeah, the financial collapse precipitated, spilled over, exacerbated the decline in the real economy thereafter, which was quite different than the relationships between the sectors of the economy. In 2000, 2001, that recession clearly started in the tech sector. Manufacturing then spilled over. And you go back to 1990, 91 recession, same thing. '81, '82, well, that was a policy, purposely precipitated recession by policy by Reagan, to make U.S. consumers and workers pay for the excess inflation that had occurred because of the oil price shocks. And there was the Saudis and others responsible for that. Well, workers and consumers paid for it with the recession to shake out the inflation. Right. 1991 was a different animal. You see, recessions aren't all alike. Mainstream economic theory, you know, is ignorant about understanding recessions. They think they're all the same, that they're all provoked by external shocks policy or supply shocks to the economy that's otherwise in equilibrium, stable. In other words, it's outside things. It's not endemic to capitalist processes that these things happen. No, it's just outside one-off kind of things. Well, in my book, 2010, Epic Recession, I describe that not all recessions are the same. You know, some are external shocks created, policy created, like in 1981. Some of them are just a natural development in business cycles that can't go on forever. And usually the contraction starts in manufacturing or construction, in goods, in other words, and then spills over from there to the rest of the services and other economy through the channel of reduced hours worked and layoffs and reduced consumption. Now, that was 1990, 2000, 2001. But, you know, the relationship between the financial side and the real side of the economy was reversed in 2008-09. You know, mainstream economists don't understand the relationships between financial cycles and real cycles, in other words. They don't understand finance very much. They weren't trained in that. You know, finance is just, we don't even count that in GDP. And it's still pretty much ignorant. There's some signs that some areas are beginning to understand this relationship between the financial and real side, but not too many. So what does that mean, the next recession here in the U.S.? Well, I think it's going to be more traditional. In other words, I think manufacturing and construction, which are already contracting, those two sectors in the U.S., you see, will cause defaults of businesses that are overloaded on debt that they can't repay, and the defaults will then spread to the financial institutions, and they will then experience defaults and problems, and that will exacerbate the real side of the economy. You know, this thing between the real and the financial side, feedback mechanisms as they spiral lower together. Well, I think it's going to originate with those companies that have, non-financial companies that have overexposed themselves to debt. I'm talking about the junk bond debt, investment grade corporate bonds, triple B. Over half of investment grade bonds are now triple B, which is really de facto junk. And junk loans called leverage loans. Now, watch those three sectors. And it probably will originate, junk bond problems will probably originate within either the retail sector or the oil and energy sector. Because global oil prices are once again contracting sharply. You know, they peaked less than a year ago at about $75 a barrel, crude oil, global crude, which is either measured by what's called West Texas crude, intermediate crude, or the Brent, in other words, Brent Sea, North Sea crude. Those are the benchmarks. And they're both now in the 50s, low 50s range from 75. In other words, they dropped about 20%. They recovered at the beginning of the year. You know, there's a big drop, about 30% last year, fourth quarter. Then they recovered in the second quarter. And then once it was clear we had this trade war problem, blew up in May, second time, then they started contracting again. Even though the Saudis and the Russians had got together and struck a deal to reduce the supply of global oil, which would raise the price. Well, that's being more than offset by U.S. shale producers producing more and more oil. They're filling the gap, you see. And Trump efforts to reduce the global supply by sanctions on Iran and Venezuela hasn't had that much effect on the price, you see. And now we're down 20% just in the last few weeks, again, in the global price of oil. And the Saudis are getting worried once again. See, the Saudis cutting just means that they're saying, we'll give up some of our market share to the U.S. shale producers. Well, why are the shale producers producing more and more, even though the price is falling? Because they got to, you see. Because if they don't sell more volume and generate revenue, even though the price is down, and they lose revenue from the price. In fact, the lower the price, the more they try to pump and sell to generate offsetting volume revenue. They got to do this. Why? Oh, because they have these big debt payments coming due for the junk bonds that they've borrowed on to increase their drilling and their output, you see. If they don't lower price to sell more, they end up not able to service their debt, pay the principal and interest on their debt. They'll go bankrupt. And that's where it's going to happen. You see, this game can't continue forever, producing more and more shale oil at some and gas, by the way. There's a glut of global natural gas. At some point, they aren't going to generate enough revenue in order to service their interest, principal and interest, and then there are going to be defaults, and that default is going to affect business confidence in the junk bond market in general, and we will see a pullback of banks and financial institutions of rolling over that debt, and there will be more defaults, and that will spill over to leveraged loans and triple B investment grade bonds. That's the transmission mechanism, you see, to the next financial crisis. But it's got to be driven by a slowdown in the real economy this time, vice versa from what happened in 2008-09. At least that's my analysis and my scenario that I see happening. Okay. And, of course, the currency war will intensify. Now that the central banks are in a race to the bottom, interest rates... It's going to happen. You know, Trump set off the currency war, which is going to exacerbate the global trade and economy situation. You know, the Chinese have stepped in and stabilized the yuan at about 7, but the market forces are going to continue to push it beyond 7.7172. And the further it goes, you know, the more the race to the bottom. And when the U.S. lowers rates in September and the ECB does as well to catch up with the other central banks, well, the other central banks are going to lower it even further. But the problem is, how far can they go? How far can the U.S. and the ECB and the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan really lower rates? They've already got $15 trillion in negative rates. And rising rapidly, over $1 trillion more in just 1 year in negative rates in Europe alone. Negative rates. Well, all this stuff isn't getting better, and it's going to get worse, and we'll be following it here on Alternative Visions. Walk the streets a screaming now.